Okay, folks, this is Alvin Shamroth here. I want to welcome you all again to our bi-weekly teleseminar on all things relevant to OBGYN board prep, oral board exam prep. Since we have new people joining us every single session, I'll just briefly say how this works. Today, we have two active participants, and so what I've done is I've muted everyone out except our active participants, and so we will have a conversation with no background noise, and everyone else can listen in. We invite you folks to participate in an active way and submit any questions you may have, cases on your cases you may have, and we go ahead and discuss them. It's totally unscripted. I never mention the candidate's last name, so even if I should ask you something and you don't know, there's no need to be embarrassed. No one will know who you are. So with that out the way, let's get straight on with what we're all here for. And I've got two very interesting and unusual cases specifically, but they have very strong relevance in a general perspective for everyone listening in. And so I'm very pleased we've got them. Let's just start first with Akhil. Akhil, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Hello, Akhil, are you there? Yes, I can.
Hey,
thank
here.
You so much.
Can you hear me?
Welcome. Thank you for joining. How do you pronounce your name? Yes,
hi,
can you hear me? I think there might be a bit of a lag.
Can you hear me?
You hear me?
Yes.
Okay, Akhil, how do you pronounce? Yes. How do you pronounce? I hear two people. I hear Akhil, I think, and our second person is Tapaswini. Tapaswini, are you there?
Yes, you did great.
Okay, welcome. And to you too. Thank you so much. All righty. Akhil, let's start with you. Just everyone should know, I've got the email that both of you sent me, but for everyone listening in, I want you to hear from their own mouth as they present the case, and then we'll dissect that because there's some very relevant issues that need to be addressed here. So, Akhil, can I ask you to go ahead and start by presenting your case, and then we can talk about it.
So there's a lot of background to this case that may or may not be relevant, but in summation, and a lot of this is stuff that I found out after the fact. But
okay, so I'm going to interrupt you for a second. There's a bit of a lag here. I apologize, folks. But I feel what I'm going to ask you to do is try and avoid any of the background that is not absolutely relevant, because in the exam, they're not going to give you 20 seconds to talk about stuff that's not relevant. Every second is critical in the exam, and so you've got to keep it as focused as you possibly can. So with that in mind, go ahead. There may be some background you feel you need to provide, and go ahead and do that, but just try and make sure everything is as focused as possible. Go ahead.
So this is a 31-year-old patient, she G5P3. She came in saying that she was a victim of sex trafficking, and on examination, she had a light bulb stuck in her vagina. She was subsequently counseled. She declined a number of evaluations, but anyway, she was taken to the OR for removal, which was actually able to be done successfully. That removal was accomplished via placing a Foley catheter posteriorly, as well as multiple Toomey syringes full of lube. And then after that lube was instilled in the vagina, it kind of allowed the light bulb to be delivered vaginally, just using irrigation. And my thought on that was, I understood that the pediatric patients for retained foreign bodies, they often used irrigation, so I thought to use lubricant as an irrigation to get that out. I think it's relevant to note she had a psychiatric provider on standby who was attempting to discuss this with her, but we had to go to the OR urgently. And I also had trauma surgery and urology both in-house on standby in case this bulb were to have ruptured and subsequent repair would be needed. And eventually she left AMA.
So I think your presentation is... Okay. I think your presentation is very good. Now, look, this is a very unusual case. Not many of us... many of us have had patients, as you mentioned, typically girls, young girls, who put foreign bodies in their vaginas, but not often do we find an adult who's put a light bulb in her vagina. Very unusual. From the exam point of view, technically, everything you've said is perfect, and the concept of putting in a Foley balloon and blowing that to try to provide pressure from behind, it shows you're thinking practically, and that's excellent. Also, what I like, you had all the various people on standby. Should the thing crush and cause untold damage in the vagina? So the management is correct. The key concern that I want to emphasize with everyone here, I'm not going to get into the psychosocial or political legal aspect of this issue or of sex trafficking. That is not part of what takes place in the exam room. So the one thing I want to emphasize, if you have any of you, if you have a case like this or something somewhat related, do not pass in the exam a moral judgment. So the fact that she's maybe a sex worker, there are issues, medical and social and gynecological, that are associated with sex working and sex trafficking, that we need to know about. That's legitimate to bring up in the exam. But do not give a snicker or a sneer or any moral judgment, because that would be very, very unprofessional. And that's the key thing I want to mention. What you've got to give consideration to, if you've got a case like this, you've got to sit back and ask yourself, where can the conversation go? So it goes to the general management of intravaginal foreign bodies, and that becomes kids. They typically present with a discharge or a bloody discharge. What's the differential diagnosis of a bloody discharge in a child? And the one thing you all need to know, I don't think any of us have ever seen it, is sarcoma botryoides. Rare as rocking horse manure, but you need to know this kind of nonsense. So just be aware of that. Where else can this go? I sort of intimated it. What are the medical, OB/GYN, and social implications that affect sex workers, and how do you manage them? So this is actually a pretty straightforward case. The key thing I want to emphasize again, don't make anything that intimates a moral judgment on your part. So Achille, I've been very brief, but did I answer the concerns that you have? Are there any other questions regarding this case that you may have?
I think two concerns. Concern number one is anatomical, and concern number two is background. So the background, it was very sketchy. If we're, like you said, not passing judgment, I don't know how to say this, But it turns out afterwards that she really just wanted repeated doses of IV narcotics. And then, you know, come to find out later, she had been seen in a number of emergency departments. This was essentially, long story short, this was actually just an elaborate pain-seeking, opioid-seeking case. And I don't know if I present this as if what I acted upon was the sex trafficking and my management, or do I, you know, even include the fact that this was actually an elaborate opioid thing.
So you raise a great point. And the answer is what many of you have heard me say multiple times. Be straightforward, be open, be honest. You can present like you presented initially, and you can add one sentence. And the sentence might be something like, I also need to tell you, on subsequent evaluation, I think this bulb in the vagina was simply a ploy to get her into the scene by doctors. She was a drug addict, an opiate addict, and this was a means of getting access to IV opiates. Say it. You've got nothing to hide for the fact that this might be her driving force. And it puts you in a very strong positive light that you can see what is really going on in this patient, and you're not letting yourself be fooled. Now, it doesn't end there. You've got to show a sensitivity to this patient, not by simply giving her opioids, no, but now you've introduced a conversation on how do you manage drug addiction. Okay, which is not outside of pregnancy, is not really our domain. And this is an office case. They're probably not going to go too much into that section. They may ask you about methadone and what's the other drug? I can't think of it at the moment. That buprenorphine, I think it is, that you know, we deal with. But the point that I want to make is, if you are thinking a certain thing about a patient, be comfortable to say it. Be very open and honest. You're only helping yourself. So again, I feel did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. Thank you. And my other question was, you know, in terms of the follow up questions, mm-hmm. I'm a little bit afraid of this case in the sense that. What do you think about the idea, like, what is my background knowledge that I need in case the thing did rupture? You know, are they going to ask all the nerves and the anatomy and the, you know, colon injury and bladder damage and the resection of the center?
I see that question. No. All of you heard Achille's question. He's concerned about being asked local anatomical issues if this light bulb should break. Let me start my response by asking you all to think of the following question. Do you think the examiner knows the anatomy of all the nerves and blood vessels of that region? And I'm sure you're all agreeing with me that no, they don't know it. And I will tell you, just by the way, there was an MOC article published, it was released for MOC about 6 months ago, on nomenclature for various gynecological anatomical issues. So number one, you need to know in that article there is a fair amount of confusion when it comes to definitions of various anatomical structures in that area. So just keep that in the back of your mind. And if you're worried that the conversation may go down that road, it's quite legitimate and appropriate to just describe what you would do in general terms. And you, yeah, same. I put in a speculum very superficially at first, see what I could find, and take out one piece at a time, making sure not to cut the edges. When everything was out and fully irrigated, I would evaluate. I might even do a cystoscopy. I might even get the general surgeon in to do a proctoscopy, just to make sure that there weren't any lacerations. The only remote chance that you might get of a specific question, and I don't know the answer to the question I'm going to pose, what arteries of any substance are there in that immediate area, and where might you expect to find them? And I'm guessing they're lateral. You know, I don't know, just on basic principles, I'm guessing that. And in the exam, you could say, you know, at the time, I was most concerned about the lateral side wall because I was concerned that that's where most of the bleeding may have come from. And that's okay. If you can look up that one question, go ahead and do that. But more than that, I don't think you need to worry too much about that. This is a very unusual, rare, specific kind of case. And try and be comfortable to answer it in general terms from a broad perspective. So, Achille, are you okay with that?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Okay, good luck. It's a nice case, and if the examiner sees it, they almost guaranteed will ask you about it because they've been spending their whole day examining candidates on PID and Trichomonas and Candidiasis and yeast. They see this and it perks them up a little bit. It's a little bit more exciting than usual. And they will ask you about it just because it's of interest sake only. But it's not more. No one, not that I'm suggesting this in your case, heaven forbid, no one's going to fail the exam because they screw up on a case like this. And you haven't screwed up. You've done it exactly correct. And you know now how to present it. Just be totally open and honest. So I feel very nice. Thank you so much for presenting that case. Tapaswini, we're going to move on to you. Just like
okay.
I started with Achille, sure, you're more than welcome. I want to, Tapaswini, I want you to read or tell us the case
mm-hmm.
that you've got so that everyone can follow, and then we can talk about it.
Sounds good. So my case is a 42-year-old female. 42-year-old female. She was Gravida 4, para 3. She presented at 33 weeks and 5 days with contractions after having intercourse. She admitted of her chronic methamphetamine abuse and admitted that most recently she snorted and injected about 3 hours before arrival. She had no prenatal care excepting for one 19-week ultrasound when she came for a UTI evaluation in ER. All her previous deliveries were cesarean at term, somewhere else, not in our hospital. Our hospital is a level 2 NICU, so we do not deliver before 34 weeks unless absolutely necessary. Now, on admission, this patient showed classic signs of methamphetamine toxicity, which included persistent severe range high blood pressure, tachycardia in 130s, agitation, tachypnea, her OSATs were 94% average, and the baby was tachycardic subsequent to the maternal tachycardia in about 170, 180 baseline. However, the accelerations were present, moderate variability. So we started off with stabilization of the mom. There were no concerns of labor. There was no scar tenderness. The cervix was closed. There was no signs of abruption because she had a non-tender uterus, no signs of bleeding. So we started off with a stabilization with IV labetalol because of her persistent severe range blood pressure. Subsequently, the maternal fetal tachycardia resolved. Her blood pressures were 120 to 130s. Her agitation improved. Her oxygen saturation improved. So we decided on not delivering and keeping her to give a beramethasone shot. Beramethasone was given. We did some investigation, including complete ultrasound. Her lab evaluation came back with fibrinogen elevated, like more than 250, so there was no signs of any DICs. We involved the ultrasound which showed an appropriate 33-week baby, no signs of any placental abruption. Other labs, they confirmed she had methamphetamine toxicity. No other drugs were found on the urine drug screen. Had elevated AST, ALT, and LDH. She had a history of hepatitis B, which was untreated. So there were some signs of increased liver enzymes.
I just want to tell you, you're being a little, you've got to, Tapaswini, you've got to, they're not going to give you this amount of time to present. So I'll let you finish, but I do want you to practice, because this is a big case for you, but I want you to practice trying to present it in about half the time that you're taking, okay? But go ahead, finish off, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay. So we involved the ICU team, we involved the pediatric team. The patient, again, became very disoriented, and she coded subsequently when the ICU team was present. We did a perimortem C-section, and ROSC was achieved about for 8 minutes after the delivery of the baby. However, subsequently lost, and we had a maternal death. And we did the autopsy. Autopsy kind of confirmed the cause of death being a methamphetamine overdose, with 150 being the toxicity level. She had 476 in her blood and a massive cardiomegaly with a marked hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So that was the cause of the death per autopsy. Obviously, this is a maternal death and...
Yeah, you're anxious about maternal death. Sure, I understand. Look, this for everyone listening in, this is the mother of all complications when you've got a maternal death. It's tragic, no matter when or how it happens. But what I'm going to say now is relevant, obviously, to a maternal death, but you could say much of what I'm saying for any complication. So for all of you, which means every one of you, you've all got complications. Mm-hmm. Ask yourself the question, and Tapaswini, I'm posing this question to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you had this patient, she died. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you had this exact same patient coming to you tomorrow, would you manage her any differently? And folks, all of you listening in, very few of you have a maternal death, but this question you should pose yourself to yourself for any complication that you may have. So if you had the same patient tomorrow, would you manage her the same or any differently?
I think the same.
And it's really important, by the way, that you be totally honest with yourself, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Forget about me. Forget about this being an exam prep question. Be honest with yourself. Would you manage this patient any differently if the same patient came to you tomorrow?
No, I would be the same management.
You would do the same management. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I would do the same management.
Yes, okay, fine. Okay. And that is 100% the correct answer. And folks, for your, all of you listening in, and you've all got complications of varying degrees, 90% of the time, the answer that Tapaswini just gave us is the exact answer that you use if they ask you that question. And if they don't ask you that question, you basically say it coming out from yourself. You say, you know, I've looked at, and you speak this way in the exam. You tell your examiner, this was obviously a tragic case, the patient died. Obviously, given this case, a lot of thought, looked at it from every possible angle, and I've come to the conclusion that as tragic as the outcome was, If I was confronted with this kind of situation tomorrow, I would manage the patient exactly the same. It shows the examiner that you understand all the issues involved, and you acknowledge that not every patient of yours is going to have a positive outcome, and you're going to have complications, and some of us, tragically, are going to have patients who die on us. It's just luck of the draw, in a sense, if it's you or me. But if we do enough work, do enough deliveries, we are going to get patients who die on us. So be comfortable to say, I don't think there's anything else I could have done differently that would have given us a different outcome. And managing this patient prospectively, I think everything was done correctly. Be comfortable to say that, okay?
Okay.
Now, there are a couple of questions that you've got to be able to answer. And, folks, this is really important for Tapaswini, but it's really relevant for everyone, because by now most of you have already come to our cases construction course, and you probably heard me mention how it's very important that you need to be able to handle any emergency, okay, no matter how esoteric it is. Now, you mentioned you did a peri-mortem C-section.
Correct.
I will tell you, it is ancient, as old as the hills, but there is a committee opinion from maybe 15, 20 years ago on this very issue.
Mm-hmm.
There's one question that comes to the fore that you, Tapaswini, and everyone else also needs to be able to answer. The question is, if a pregnant woman, let's say she's at term, is shot in the head and killed and is brain dead instantaneously, how long do you have to get in and get that baby out? How long do you have before you're talking about bringing out a flat and the baby that's not going to make it? Do you know what that time is?
7 minutes.
No. 7 minutes would be very harsh. It's about 20 to 25 minutes. I mean, obviously, the quicker the better, the less neonatal hypoxia. But this is going to happen in the streets. You've basically got to get them into the OR and cut immediately, 20 minutes, to get the baby's head out. Once the baby's head is out and you can suction them out, baby's breathing air, room air, oxygen, you're okay and you can relax. That's about 20 minutes, okay? That's number one. Now, the second case question, similarly, all of you need to be able to answer, and even you, Tapaswini, need to answer this, because although your patient was dying and you did a perimortem C-section, they can ask you, how would you do a C-section? Yeah, with a perimortem patient, you don't care about anesthesia, correct? You just go ahead and cut and you're done. Is that what you did?
Yes.
Yeah, but if the patient is not perimortem, if this patient was not dying, and you've got a patient who's developed, for whatever reason, a terminal fetal bradycardia, and there's no anesthetist around for the next hour. What's the question they're going to pose to you? How would you do a C-section under local anesthetic? Okay? So, Tapaswini, that's my question to you. What are the issues to keep in mind when doing a C-section under local anesthetic.
Okay. Obviously, this is a very hard question. I've never faced this problem before, but injecting local anesthesia to her belly.
I'm so pleased that you brought this case because it's important. Yeah. Carry on. Go ahead.
And ensuring, if I do not have any intubation or any general anesthesia available, then at least giving the patient some kind of sedation is what I would do.
Okay. So look. I'm not going to waste too much time on this because you're not wrong, but you're missing the meat of the question. A couple of things you need to say. I'm just going to go through them with you.
Mm-hmm.
In order not to get into lidocaine toxicity, you can, in a typical weighted woman, you can typically give no more than 50 or 60 cc's of lidocaine. And it varies a little bit if it's with epinephrine or without. But remember, you're limited to about 50, 60 cc's.
Mm.
If you're limited, what then are the layers that you're going to infiltrate? Because you've got to use it very sparingly. And the answer is you infiltrate immediate subcutaneous tissue because the skin has pain fibers. You
mm-hmm.
infiltrate immediately parietal peritoneum. You don't have to do sheath. There's no pain fibers there. So peritoneum is the next layer. And then you do visceral peritoneum just over the where you would make the bladder flap. You do not pack the pericardial gutters because they will vomit and, you know, that's really painful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a quick technique, in and out. And when the baby is out, you don't exteriorize the uterus to close it. You close it in the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
mm-hmm.
again, the entire peritoneum is full of pain fibers, and it's
mm-hmm.
absolute torture. That's the first thing, and the second thing, what are the signs
mm-hmm.
of increasing lidocaine toxicity? Because this is your big concern. Do you have any idea what those might be?
Metallic taste in the mouth is one of the signs of lidocaine toxicity. I cannot think of anything else.
Yeah. Periolar anesthesia.
Yes, perioral tingling.
Okay. As the level of so you get tingling in the fingers and perioral tingling. As the level of toxicity increases, you'll get increasing levels of conscious, what's the word I'm looking for? You suppress their conscience, become more and more sleepy and out of it. I can't think of a medical term for that. And eventually they start slowing down their respiratory rate, their heart rate, and they can get arrhythmias and seizures, and eventually if it's too toxic, they stop breathing. You've got to ventilate them. So that's where your conversation has a good chance of going, and that's where you need to be prepared. What you need to be prepared for. By the way, folks, those of you who are going to be attending our definitive board prep course, which the first one actually is next month in June. It's a Zoom in-person live. It's a live Zoom course if you're interested. But we're gonna discuss this very issue. So we've got you covered for those of you who are coming. I know most of you are going to be there. So that's the issue here.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you just for your sake, Papa Sumi. About 8 years ago, or certainly, there was a committee opinion specifically on amphetamine abuse. I would encourage you just to read that very quickly.
Okay.
And also, be and this goes to everyone. Be ready for a conversation on the social, the obstetric, and the gynecological, and the medical consequences of drug addiction, because that's where they can go with you on this as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think they ask me about specific like ACLS protocol and stuff, because we did ACLS for quite some time?
Oh, ACLS. Okay. Okay. I know. Everyone panics about this. Again, like I said earlier, do you think your examiner knows how to run a code? There's not a chance in hell that they could do that. So if they asked me, I would say I would call the code, and in the interim, I would start with the basic principles A, B, C, D, that I'm guessing you're familiar with, and that's more than adequate. I absolutely would not spend my time learning how to run a code for a case like this or any other case. It's just there are so many other way more important things to learn. I just don't think it's necessary. And in practice too, we don't run codes in practice. Heaven forbid we ever faced with it. We call the folks in to do it. The ICU people come in, you know. So it's not really necessary. I don't think you need to worry about that. Okay.
Okay.
Tapaswini, any other questions that you may have? You okay with that?
Yes, I think I'm okay with it. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. So listen, I can sum up both of these cases with one common response, which is a response many of you have heard me give many times over the last several months. Be open, be honest, just be yourself. Share with your examiner what you're thinking in your head. And I tell people, think aloud. Let the examiner into your head. Let them know how you're thinking, how you're coming to your conclusions. It's the best way to answer any question. But be open and honest. I can't emphasize that enough. All right. So listen, we're done. Just very, very briefly. Again, thank you so much to Akhil and Tapaswini. And I want to encourage you folks for the next several sessions. Volunteer to be on the hot seat. I'm not an offensive guy. I'm a pretty mild guy, and I'm not out to belittle anyone. There's nothing gained in that. And it's a very good experience to get, and it's free. So I encourage every single one of you, get as much exposure to being on the hot seat as you possibly can. So I will tell you again, we're starting our definitive board prep season. Our first course will be, in fact, our only course will it's a 6-day course. The first 2 days are always provided online, and the last 4 days, if you want to attend the course in June, it's somewhere like the third week of June, then the last 4 days are online as well. If you want to come in person, then we've got another 4 courses in July, August, September, 2 in Baltimore, 2 in Los Angeles. I'm not sure of the exact dates, but if you're interested, you can look that up. And I encourage you to join. It's a lot of fun. It's very worthwhile. And I can just guarantee you that you'll feel very pleased that you attended. So, folks, with all that being said, our next teleseminar will be on June the 9th, which is 2 weeks from today, June the 9th. And we'll do this all over again. Please, folks, feel comfortable to volunteer to be on the hot seat. So folks, thank you to Tapa Zwimi, thank you to Achil, thanks to everyone joining in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you once again. Take care, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye.